Welcome to Global Talk, an international affairs podcast from The National. I'm Justin Vella. Today I'm speaking with Ayman Jawad Al-Tamimi, an Iraqi-British analyst who is focused on studying the new Islamist militant groups that are emerging across the Middle East. Last week we saw the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which has established itself in large tracts of territory in Iraq and Syria, declare a new caliphate and change their name to the Islamic State. Now that this is done, what does the Islamic State want? Is it focused on expanding its territory, or is it focused on securing its foothold in areas that it already has?
As the declaration of the Islamic State suggests, it implies a transitional project, the caliphate namely, which is essentially an empire that would, firstly, it would expand across, it would encompass the entire Muslim world, but then eventually it should encompass the entire world. Now, this kind of messaging actually has long been around with the Islamic State's discourse, both now and in its previous incarnations of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq, in Iraq and Asham, and of course, actually also going back to ISI, the Islamic State of Iraq, which was the predecessor to ISIS. The messaging actually became of global aspirations became particularly apparent last year, as ISIS began to build its territory across Syria. So you already actually in August 2013 you had a video where released via ISIS's media wing Al-Furqan Media, where a fighter said that it was necessary to establish an Islamic State over the entire world. And then you would have slogans like Al-Khilaf Al-Ma'ud, the promised project of the caliphate, and you'd have billboards like Nara Shajarat Al-Khilafa, together we cultivate the tree of the caliphate. So it's been very apparent for quite a while, actually, that ISIS has been, the Islamic State, and in its previous incarnations, has been quite open about the global nature of its struggle. The self-proclaimed caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his recent message about conquering Rome and Muslims becoming masters of the whole world. So in terms of what this means for ISIS's ambition, what it means for the Islamic State's ambitions, it definitely means, I think it's both. There is both consolidating territory and expanding. So, for example, the Islamic State definitely believes in the conquest of Baghdad. But at the same time, of course, they'll use their resources, for example, to consolidate their power in Mosul at the expense of other factors.
And what also seems clear right now is that the Islamic State is fighting alongside other Sunni groups in Iraq. Maybe you could give us some examples of who runs or who manages, you know, the day-to-day affairs in areas that these groups have taken over with ISIS's help. Is it ISIS or the Islamic State now, or is it other groups?
I think you have to assess on a case-by-case basis. So actually still in Fallujah, the Islamic State does not have full control over the city. It's been the city that's been longest out of government control, I mean since January. But it's still actually not exclusively ISIS, or still not exclusively the Islamic State, although as ISIS and so on, there's no doubt that the power base has been built up over time. And part of what enables that is the fact that the Islamic State has much better financial resources than the other groups, right, which eventually, of course, they've built up for years through extortion, oil smuggling, and so on. That enables the Islamic State, for example, to engage in outreach to locals through dawah meetings, through provision of food, say, for example, actually even public buildings. So, for example, schools in Fallujah and even a planned hospital in Mosul. But there's one trend I think you could discern. Is that when there's a move into an urban area, whatever role other insurgents might have played in creating a vacuum of government control, it tends to be the Islamic State can assert its authority. So two examples of this. By these, I'm talking about localities, you know, where you don't have a population of millions, like in Mosul, which mm-hmm. I think is one of Iraq's largest cities, but say Tikrit and Hawija. It's very clear that other groups had a part in pushing out government control. So, for example, in Tikrit, Jamaat and Sa'ar al-Islam, who are the jihadi rivals of ISIS, of the Islamic State, because they don't accept the Islamic State's claims to be a state. They would like to work with the Islamic State, but on equal footing as groups, not one being subordinate to the other by virtue of statehood. And also in Tikrit, the Naqshbandi army, the Ba'athist insurgent networks played a role as well. But it was clear actually that what was then ISIS moved in to assert control over the actual city, and the same thing happened in Hawija near Kirkuk, where you also had other insurgents playing a role, but ISIS moved into the city area and established itself, because ISIS put big emphasis on holding parades and waving and flying their banner and so on.
Maybe you can give us an idea of what proportion of this unrest is being carried out by Sunni Iraqis that are upset with the government in Baghdad, and what percentage of it is the Islamic State. I'm kind of wondering, is the Islamic State the tip of the sword for this Sunni unrest,
or
is it the entire thing?
I think tip of the sword is a good image actually to use for this, because I think the majority of insurgent offensives that lead to the new territory falling out of government control, I think you can fair to say ISIS, what was ISIS and now the United States spearheaded most of that. And then there is, of course, that you can't overlook the Islamic State's superior financial resources and so on. So in Mosul, for example, in Mosul, which is the main example, there are groups in the city, but it's clear that the Islamic State's power is growing. That's reflected, for example, in many members, dozens of members, actually, of Jamaat and Sa'ar al-Islam, led by a local commander and a Sharia official in Mosul, pledged allegiance to the Islamic State recently. And it's clear, of course, in the long run that the Islamic State, of course, intends to be the sole authority over all these areas. But anyway, if I could give a percentage to the insurgency, how much of it is the Islamic State? Maybe somewhere between a third and a half, and I stress that percentage is 33%, 50%. I stress that is quite arbitrary.
Talking about how to subdue the violence in Iraq at the moment, do Iraq Sunnis have a widely accepted set of leaders who, in theory, could join some kind of unity parliament and call for an end to this uprising?
I don't think so. You get these you get people, for example, like Ali Hatem, who he's busy right now speaking to journalists in Erbil, telling them that, you know, if the government meets their demands, then the tribesmen will come together, the Sunni Arab tribesmen will come to fight the Islamic State, and then until then they will work with the Islamic State against the government. But Ali Hatem set up his own military council in Anbar in January, but there's really been no evidence so far that it has, that one, it's either expanded out of that, or two, that it exercises any real control over any significant influence within the overall insurgency. And then on the other hand, you have these politicians, the Najafi brothers, Rafia Itawi, and so on. What can they do? Their careers depend on being part of the political system, however disillusioned they might be with it. And, you know, who was one of the governors? Who was the governor of Nineveh province? That was Asil Najafi, and that's the province is pretty much completely out of his control, and he has no actual capacity as a provincial governor. So really, I think the leadership, the trend has just been since the beginning of last year, is that there's been more and more disillusionment from the mainstream political class, and increasingly they're just less and less representative of their constituency. That doesn't mean, though, I don't think there could be. That doesn't mean I don't think there's any solution to this crisis. I think it's fair to say that Maliki really would have to go, because there's no way he can really negotiate with any potential representatives from within the insurgency or activists on the ground.
You've argued that partitioning Iraq would lead to a worse outcome than, you know, what is already happening now in the country. The country appears very divided right now, but how would a formal partition make it worse?
Well, in particular, this applies to the Sunni Arab areas. If you decide to partition that and just call it Sunnistan and leave it to its own devices, well, firstly, there's going to be no more government money coming in from Baghdad. The bulk of the country's revenues have been coming from southern oil reserves, from southern oil production. There's been a lot of disruption to oil production in the north for quite some time now. But there'll be no money coming in. There'll be warlordism much like Syria. If we look at Syria, that's effectively kind of a de facto partition now, into a Sunni stan and so on. This Sunni stan, it's just countless different groups competing with each other for wealth, and there's been little benefit in the lives of locals. I know Kirk Sowell, actually, of Inside Iraqi Politics, he said that in the long run, the situation in this Sunni stan would be like Gaza. Economically, that is, and I don't think that's an inapt analogy.
What about the other areas as well? You know, the Kurdish area in the north, and the Shia in the south.
Yeah, I was going to come on to the Kurdish area. Well, the problem is that again, if they decide to just break up, they still haven't yet compensated with whatever independent oil revenues they make. They haven't compensated for. They can't compensate yet for the fact that the central government has provided the bulk of their budget. And given also that we've seen Turkey's opposition to notions of Kurdish independence, effectively this Kurdistan would become a de facto client state of Turkey. And as for the Shia stand, notional Shia stand in the south. Well, economically, this would be the best off of the three areas. But you still have this issue, for example, how would you sort out Diyala province, Babil province, where you've got large numbers of Sunni Arabs? You just say, and the Baghdad Belt area, you just say we're going to cleanse Sunni Arabs on that. I think it would be at a terrible human cost. But also, I think that such a Shia-Stan arrangement actually would be conducive just to ever more Iranian influence in the country.
You've been listening to Ayman Jawad al-Tamimi, an Iraqi-British analyst that focuses on the new Islamist militant groups that are emerging across the Middle East. For more of The National's Iraq coverage, visit thenational.ae.